From WBUR Boston, I'm Mike Peskin for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Author Zakes Mda is one of the most prominent South African writers of our time, with plays and poems and novels that have earned him worldwide acclaim. From rebelling against his father to falling in love time and time again to witnessing his country transition out of apartheid and go through one of the biggest socio-political shifts in its history, he's seen it all, digesting and documenting along the way. This hour on Point, a South African journey through the words of Zakes Mda. And you can join the conversation. Did you live through apartheid? Have you read any of Zakes Mda's works? You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from Athens, Ohio, is Zakes Mda. His new autobiography is Sometimes There Is a Void, Memoirs of an Outsider. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Zakes Mda, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Mike.
So you were born into, I think it can be called, the upper class of black South Africans. Your people were educated people, lawyers, civil servants. Is that about right?
That's right. When I was born, my father was a teacher and my mother was a nurse. But later he became a lawyer and practiced law for some years. But at the same time, he was also a political activist. He was the founding member of the ANC Youth League and its president as well. The ANC Youth League, which is the ruling party in South Africa today, I mean, the post-apartheid era.
Yes. A.P. Mda, that was his name, Ashby Peter Mda. Mm-hmm. What was he like as a dad?
Oh, man, my father was very, very strict. You know, he had what today I would call, you know, military discipline. We had to stand to attention when we spoke with him, you know, and we had to respond all the time to show that we were paying attention. So he was a very strict man, you know, very rigid in his ways.
There was one thing he would say to you when you misbehaved: Africa cannot afford to have people who do such things. And I'm thinking of adopting that with my own 3 and 4 year old. I don't know if I would say Manhattan cannot afford that, but it seems like a good and serious line.
Oh, yeah, because you see, he was so much dedicated to the liberation of Africa that he viewed every aspect of life in terms of the freedom struggle, not only for South Africa, because he was a pan-Africanist, mm-hmm. but for the African continent as a whole. But not only the African continent, the diaspora as well, you know, Africa and its diaspora. That's a pan-Africanist view.
There's a passage early on in your book about when you were a boy and you were in a store with your father. I think you have that in front of you. Could you read that for us? It gives us a sense of your relationship to him.
Yes. He was at the counter buying fish and chips for our lunch, and I was standing next to him. A mad woman in dirty, tattered clothes approached me, smiling. She really scared me, so I moved to the other side of my father. But he thought I was afraid of a white boy about my age, who had also approached the counter at the same time. He reprimanded me right there in public for giving way to the boy just because he was white, and lectured me on how I was just as good as the boy and had no business to be afraid of white people. I just stood there feeling small. I dare not defend myself by saying that I was escaping the mad black woman and not the white boy.
That encapsulates what I took away from the dynamic between you in a couple ways. One was that your father gave you good information, but perhaps didn't convey it with the right touch. There were stern lessons at the table, and you credit him for your political consciousness, but perhaps he wasn't speaking to a, you know, impressionable, young, quite shy young child.
Yes, because, of course, you see, I thought at the time, of course, that is the way of the fathers. You know, that's how fathers are generally. But of course, I learned that, well, it was just him because, you know, of his intensity in as far as the freedom struggle was concerned. He was like that. And of course, because of his sternness and strict discipline, I rebelled against him as a young boy growing up. But of course, on looking back today, I see that I've learned many good lessons from him, especially lessons on humility, on tolerance. And in fact, in many respects, I have become him.
Mm. I would describe you, as you write about yourself, as a sweet-natured young boy, but not necessarily well-behaved.
Well, if you say so.
Okay. And the other really interesting thing I found about your father, I am a sports reporter, and I covered the World Cup in South Africa. And the Orlando Pirates, there are two great soccer teams there in South Africa, the Orlando Pirates and the Kaizer Chiefs, and they have a great rivalry. And am I right? The Orlando Pirates got their name because your father was a teacher to those boys, and he was teaching Treasure Island at the time, and they adopted the name Pirates as a result?
In fact, that's where the name came from. Many Amazing. People in South Africa don't know that. You know, Orlando Pirates was actually founded by his students. He was a literature teacher at the time at John Bachman School in Orlando East. And one of their set books was Treasure Island, with which the students, you know, fell in love because he used to teach that very well. So they named their team then Orlando Pirates. At the time, it was just a small team of the students there. It later, of course, became, you know, one of the major soccer teams in South Africa up to this day.
And if viewers remember the World Cup and the vuvuzela sound, it's unsure where the vuvuzela came from, but one story is that originated at Orlando Pirates games.
That's a much later invention, you see.
Yes, I know. So what prompted your family's exile to Lesotho?
What happened was that my father, because of his political activities, whilst he was practicing as a lawyer, he was arrested by the apartheid government and fortunately was able to escape and then crossed the border to Lesotho, which is in fact a neighboring country. It was called Basotoland then, and it was a British colony at the time. So He became a refugee there. Later, I was arrested myself, not for my own sins, but for his sins, you know, because sometimes we do suffer for the sins of our fathers. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, now that the apartheid government could not get him, they thought they would get me instead. So I had to escape as well to follow him into exile.
And how old were you at the time?
I was about 12 or 13 at the time. So that's how then we became refugees. And that was the beginning, of course, of my outsiderness, which has continued from that time onwards.
And it was an odd kind of exile. In one of your writings, I think you referred to it, or others refer to this as almost an inzile is the word that I've seen used.
Uh-huh. Well, although, of course, Lesotho is a different country altogether, even though it is completely surrounded by South Africa. At the time, it was a British colony, whereas Lesotho was under apartheid, and therefore quite a few people from South Africa went to Lesotho as refugees and were given asylum by the British. When Lesotho got her independence in 1966, it continued to be an independent country from South Africa, and it continued to welcome refugees from South Africa who were fighting against apartheid. So it became a very useful base for our freedom struggle.
Right. And when did the artistry take hold? When did you first start writing or painting or writing poems?
Well, I've always been a writer, I think, even though I didn't know it at the time, because when my father was a teacher, before he went back to school to study law, you know, he exposed me to a lot of literature. You know, he would recite, you know, from Shakespeare, you know, from Macbeth, Julius Caesar, and so on. Even before I could read, you know, I knew those passages, you know, from Shakespeare. And on occasion when I would visit my grandmother in the village, there I would encounter storytellers in the oral tradition, the ancient storytelling of Africa. So, you see, these two cultures came together in a syncretic way.
Yes.
And I felt that I should also write my own stories.
This is On Point. I'm Mike Peskin for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with prominent South African writer Zakes Mda about his life under apartheid and his new autobiography, Sometimes There Is a Void. Perhaps memoir would be a better word, and we'll get into the distinction. A key figure in Mda's life and the key figure in the modern South Africa is Nelson Mandela. Here is Mandela in his 1994 inaugural address.
Never, never, and never again shall it be that this beautiful land will again experience the oppression of one by another.
Zakes, I wanted to next ask you about coming to America, although let me preface that. You were cartooning. You were writing for newspapers. You had first started to write some plays. Why those forms?
Well, it just so happened that, you know, those were the forms that I came into contact with, you know, quite early on. Cartooning was part of my political activism in Lesotho, you know, during those years of the struggle. And I cartooned mostly for political newspapers, you know, ridiculing politicians of the opposition or on the opposite side. But playwriting came when I was at high school, when I saw some wonderful plays by a black South African writer called Gibson Kente, who used to have a touring theater company, you know, that traveled to every city, every town, even the smallest town in South Africa, performing, you know, musical plays. So I fell in love with his plays, and I thought that, well, I could write plays myself. And in fact, I did. So quite early on, then I was a playwright and wrote quite a number of plays that were performed not only in South Africa, but in England, in this country as well, in America. They continue to be performed.
When you were writing plays, is this about the period that you were, well, I think we could say would-be assassin, but the would-be is very questionable and in italics.
Well, that was before I wrote plays, in mm-hmm. fact.
And what happened?
When I got involved with political organizations that were, you know, involved in the armed struggle. And as little boys who were members of these groups, you know, who were used by the older people, you know, to do their dirty work for them. And I remember on one occasion, my friend and me were given guns and were required to go and assassinate one man who was in fact a member of our party, but we were told that he was in fact a spy, you know, of the opposite party. Fortunately, when the man approached and we were about to do the dirty deed, we got cold feet and we surrendered to him, you know, and confessed that in fact we were there to assassinate him. That was the closest I ever came, you know, to a situation like that. And in fact, you see, I left that group after that, you know, and didn't have anything to do with it again.
And it was common for those in your milieu, for those who went to your high school, to take up arms in the struggle, but you avoided that, and then I think later on you probably consciously decided that would not be your method of insurrection.
I decided that would not be my method, not because I was on principle against the armed struggle as such, you know, because we all believed that that was the only way we were going to be liberated. But I thought that for me personally, you know, it was not something I could bring myself to do. And I explored other avenues of engaging in the struggle, using art, you know, as a weapon against the system that we were fighting.
What was your first play that got really widespread or even international acclaim?
Well, my first play that got acclaim was We Shall Sing for the Fatherland, which in fact continues to be performed internationally up to this day. It won quite a few awards then, but then it was banned, you know, by the apartheid government, and it became illegal for anybody to be seen with a copy of that play. You would go to jail if you were to be found reading that play, you know.
It was, I think I've heard you describe it as or acknowledge that it was essentially a work of agitprop, even though it might have had its merits as well.
Well, you see, that is what we were writing. In
yeah.
fact, you see, we were writing agitprop. We consciously went out of our way to write agitprop because our theater was not art for its own sake. It was there and it was meant to mobilize people against the system that we were fighting.
Well, given that you were oppressed, given that the police state was, you know, murdering people you know, do you look back and think that subtlety in the written form was a luxury that those that you and your contemporaries didn't even consider?
Well, that question, in fact, can be answered by the works themselves.
Yeah.
The fact that apartheid is no longer there, we live in a new South Africa, yet those plays that I wrote during that period continue to be performed in South Africa and elsewhere, even in Canada or in America. They continue to be performed, you know, by university groups and all that. It means that there was or there is something in them other than, you know, the message itself, which was against apartheid. You know, the art of the theater, you see. Because they have lived beyond the occasion, namely beyond apartheid, you know, which they were addressing at the time.
Personally, those plays brought you from South Africa to Ohio, Athens, Ohio, where you are now. So something about that place must have had a hold on you since we're talking about 1981 that you came over here. At that time, as you were a student and often a struggling student, did you feel guilt that whatever you had to do to contribute to the struggle against apartheid had to be done from thousands of miles away?
Well, I didn't feel guilt at all because we believed that our struggle would be a very protracted one, and it was important for us to prepare ourselves for it. So it was part of the preparation. When I came to Athens, Ohio in 1981, invited by a playwright here called C. Berry Queen to study playwriting under him, you know, it was because he had read my plays, you know, and fell in love with them and thought, yeah, well, in fact, we should have this man over here to America. And I knew that, well, I'll be here, maybe do my MFA in playwriting, and then go back to Southern Africa, you know, to continue the struggle.
And I love the story in your book. Your benefactor when you were almost penniless in Ohio was Jane Fonda.
Yes. But, I first met him in Lesotho. In fact, I met her. Sorry.
Yeah.
I first met her in Lesotho, and then when I was at Ohio University here. In 1982 or 1983, I got in touch with her, and it was at the time when she was trying to make a movie set in South Africa, and was looking for, you know, the right property. So she engaged my services as a script consultant, and that helped me quite a lot, you know, for my living expenses here.
And did the what movie did that become?
Oh, the movie did not happen,
yeah.
You know. She gave up the idea because she later told me after 2 or 3 years that she couldn't find the right property. A story that would be powerful on its own right, not on the merits of the politics, you know.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, to fast forward a couple of years, I want to take you to the moment when apartheid fell. It was momentous. First, let's hear a news clip. This was as conveyed on CNN, and I want to ask you where you were for all of this.
There appeared no way out. The only resolution appeared to be one of armed conflict, of ever intensifying revolution. There appeared to be no way ahead whatsoever. All of a sudden, F.W. de Klerk makes major announcements. He unbans political organizations. He releases Nelson Mandela. A whole new ballgame is underway.
To we outsiders, it seemed like this struggle took so long, and then it all happened all at once. How did it seem to you, both an insider and an outsider?
Well, in fact, more as an outsider, because at that time, I was not in South Africa. I was in Vermont. I was teaching at the University of Vermont at that time. And I do remember that broadcast very, very well, you know. And to us also, you know, it seemed, it just happened all of a sudden. We were expecting, as I said, a very long struggle. We were expecting a protracted a struggle. And things just changed like that.
And what about your father? What was he doing at this time?
My father had died the previous year.
Yeah.
So he missed that moment.
And this was, now your father, sometimes it becomes confusing. He was a member of the BNP or the PAC?
No. At first, of course, he was a member of the ANC.
The African National Congress, right.
Yeah, the president of the ANC Youth League and its founder. But he was also then part of the group that got disillusioned with the ANC and formed the PAC, the Pan-Africanist Congress, in 1959.
And I've read that at times they were sort of the most anti-communist, but then at other times they all but embraced Maoism.
Well, they were, in fact, supported by Communist China.
Mm-hmm.
They were, in many respects, because you must remember that during the Cold War, these superpowers also fought, you know, proxy wars in these third world countries. So you'll find that at that time, the ANC was supported by the Soviet Union and, of course, the Communist Party. And the PAC, on the other hand, was supported by the Communist China, and adopted, you know, Maoist strategies in their struggle.
Although when you ask this great anecdote, when you would ask the common person what they thought of Mao, they would say, oh, she would be a terrible person because Mao was...
Oh, you mean in Lesotho?
Yes.
That was now, in a different country.
Yeah.
With the peasants in Lesotho when we were campaigning. The word Mao in Lesotho means your mother.
Yeah, so she would be a terrible person, yeah.
Yeah, you see that. So there was that confusion amongst the common people in Lesotho there.
Mandela is president. The ANC becomes powerful. To you, this was not an abstraction or an ideal. Mandela was a man in your home, a man who your female relatives would gossip about his handsomeness.
Yes, Mandela went from a very early age. I mean, when I was a little boy, was a regular at home. So I interacted with him very closely many, many years before he was arrested and went to Robben Island and so on. So he was like part of the family. You will remember that my father, as the president of the ANC Youth League, had as his committee, you know, Nelson Mandela, Oliver Tambo, Walter Sisulu, you see, all those leaders of the ANC. So they were part and parcel of the environment, you know, that I grew up in.
And it gave you standing, I take it, when you put on your hat as a journalist, another hat that you would wear, it gave you standing to talk about them not as the sort of secular saints that many of these leaders were interpreted to be by the populace.
Yes, because, you see, I knew them before, you know, they were canonized by the world. So to me, Mandela has always been just a man like any other man, like my father. And so on. And in many respects, he was just as strict, actually, those days, as my father was.
So stay with us because we're going to talk about your later dealings with Nelson Mandela, a long letter you wrote to him in a meeting that he set up. We'll also talk about, we haven't even touched on, how you began to write novels, and that was an interesting transition. Zakesim, to stay with us. We'll be talking with the great South African writer and playwright about how the anti-apartheid movement has helped shape him as a man and an artist. We've been playing some of the songs and music that are important to Zakesim, a huge jazz aficionado. In the last segment, we played a little Miriam Makeba, also known as Mama Africa. She was singing Pata Pata. This is the unmistakable Hugh Masekela, one of Zake's musical heroes, and anyone who really likes trumpet and jazz would share that opinion. This is Grazin' in the Grass. I'm Mike Peskin for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mike Peskin for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with South African writer Zakesim Mda about his life and words and the changes in his home country of South Africa. Last month marked the centennial of the African National Congress. Here's South African President Jacob Zuma marking the moment.
We make a clear call to all South Africans to work with us to make the dream of a united, democratic, non-racial, and non-sexist and prosperous South Africa a reality in our lifetime.
And soon we will get to discussing the politics of South Africa and also how Zakesim Mda became a novelist, and you're invited to join the conversation. Do you feel the U.S. has some lessons to learn in South Africa? We just heard Jacob Zuma talking about non-racial and non-sexist South African. That's in the Constitution. Zeke Sumta joins me from Athens, Ohio. He's a professor of creative writing at Ohio University. So, Zeke, we haven't even talked about the area where you gained the most acclaim writing novels. In your autobiography, in your memoir, you write flat out, you did not think of yourself as a, quote, prose person. So what inspired you to first take up that form?
Oh, well, you know, it was actually an accident. Because, as you rightly point out, I've always been a playwright. I was a dialogue person. I never thought that I could write sustained prose and be descriptive and, you know. But it happened one day when I was working at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, where I was a research fellow. You see, first of all, let me say that before all this, when I wrote my plays, I wrote them longhand, you know, on pen and paper. And then I would type them later or get someone else to type them. So I thought, well, maybe it's high time that I got onto the technological age. And fortunately, in a student newspaper, somebody was advertising an old computer there. So I phoned this woman. She brought the computer, you know, an old IBM monster, you know, which was as big as the table.
Yeah.
So it happened one day on Sunday when my wife had gone to church. Actually, it was on Christmas Day. And I was at home with our little four-month-old baby. So I thought, well, baby, let me just tinker around with this computer and see how it functioned. So I got the manual, you know, WordPerfect, and then typed "There are many ways of dying." I fell in love with that sentence. And then the next sentence followed, and another one. By the time my wife came back from church, I had two pages of what became my first novel, Ways of Dying. And I was amazed that I had actually written sustained prose. And I thought, well, thanks to this computer, I'm going to write my first novel. So that's how it came about.
I see Ways of Dying as a middle ground between the play and the novel in that it takes a peculiar, not singular or unique, but peculiar form. It's written in the second person plural, meaning it is narrated by a we. Here is a small passage from the book. When they say it once happened, we are the they. No individual owns a story. Josh Ferris wrote a book called Then We Came to an End a couple years ago about an ad agency. But the we in your novel, Ways of Dying, the reader acclimates to it quite easily. But I definitely see it as a gradual step from the drama to the novel.
Okay. Yeah, maybe because, you know, the theater continues to have a very strong impact.
Yeah.
In my prose writing as well. Many critics have commented that, in fact, my novels are very visual. It is because of my playwriting, but also of my training as a screenwriter, I see. And, of course, that communal voice that you hear in Ways of Dying is also the voice of our oral tradition, which means that now I draw from the sources of my grandmother. You know, the stories that I used to hear as a little boy, you know, it all comes together now, you know.
Yeah.
I draw from all the various sources, you know, from magical realism, from the oral traditions of my people and so on.
So you're going back hundreds of years, but you're also looking at the great South African novelist. Maybe we could say the other great besides you, South African novelist, J.M. Coetzee.
Yes.
It was Coetzee had a character. There was just one phrase about how he smelled, and that was one of your inspirations for Ways of Dying.
That was one of my inspirations for that novel, yes. I was fascinated by a character called Vacuel in Coetzee's Age of Iron. And he has quite a rich smell. Well, because he's a hobo.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, if Coetzee can create a character who smells like this, so can I. That's when I created my own character. But mine, of course, had to smell for different reasons. I made him a professional mourner. He travels from funeral to funeral, mourning the dead. He's an angel of death in that way, and therefore he must smell like death.
A later novel, not the next, but a later novel, was to be called Yuyulence. What was wrong with that title?
Oh, well, that's from To Yululate, you know. But I must take you to an African village so that you can urinate there.
I'm sure I'll get this, well, my, the lasting my, gig, my, the urinator in residence gig.
In residence, yeah. Well, my publisher did not think that it's an attractive title because people would not understand it. So that's a novel that later became Heart of Redness.
And that title gave you grief over the years because people would read The Heart of Redness and say, oh, this is obviously a play on and a comment on Heart of Darkness, the Joseph Conrad book, and it just wasn't.
They would see intertextuality. Actually, many scholarly papers have been written on the intertextuality between Heart of Redness and Heart of Darkness. What? But then when I wrote the Heart of Redness, I had not read Heart of Darkness. Actually, I still have not read Heart of Darkness. But of course, that doesn't mean that there can't be any intertextualities because, you know, both books are about life. You know, they draw from the human condition in one way or the other. So there will be intertextualities if you look hard enough.
Another of your books has an interesting theme and a distinction, The Madonna of Excelsior, based on a real event. But it was one of the few times, if not the only time, where a black South African writer just embodies the characters that he writes about are Afrikaners. So here we have a black South African writing with a mostly Afrikaner cast.
Oh, yes. Yes. That's what happens in the Madonna. Why? Because the book is set during the apartheid period in the Free State, which is, you know, mostly Afrikaners there. But then it shuttles between the past and the present, you know, the post-apartheid period, to look at those characters, you know, what they are doing today in post-apartheid South Africa.
And the real Excelsior, what was the story there?
The story of the real Excelsior, during apartheid, of course, there were laws which were against sexual relations between different races. The law was known as the Immorality Act. So it so happened that in the town of Excelsior, a number of children were born. You know, children in South Africa who would be referred to as colored children. In South Africa, colored means mixed race, you know, between black and white.
Mm-hmm.
So it was discovered that a number of white Afrikaner people there had sexual relations with black women. As a result, those children were born. And they were, of course, arrested for that because it was a criminal offense. Now, later then, I was quite curious to know, to find out what happened to those people in Excelsior. What happened to the black women and those white men and to their children, who would be adults, of course, today. So I went back to research this story, and I was quite fascinated by what had happened and decided to write a novel set there. But a novel that draws from that real life situation, that even uses newspaper articles as part and parcel of my storytelling in that novel.
Let's talk a bit about politics, and let's let James from Brookline, Massachusetts, take us there. James, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Zakes. I'm a fan of Red Heart of Redness and Ways of Dying, which I both enjoy tremendously.
Zakes, oh, thank you very much.
You. What do you think your father might say of the current state of South Africa, given the terrible level of inequality, violence, xenophobia, corruption starting right from the beginning of the first ANC administration? If your father would be I assume he's gone. If he would be alive and able to assess things now, what do you think he might say?
Thank you for the call, James.
Well, it's quite difficult to speak for the dead, James. But I suspect, maybe I'm speaking for myself here, he would be disappointed, you know. Maybe that's a way of also telling you that I'm quite disappointed about many things, some of which you have mentioned, such as the xenophobia that that we see in my country. I am disappointed. Maybe he would be disappointed too. In fact, I think he would. I'm quite proud of what my country has achieved. For instance, in the field of human rights, you know, we have inculcated a new culture of human rights in South Africa, I mean, which were brought about by the ANC. For instance, you did mention in our constitution, you know, sexual orientation, for instance. In South Africa, it is not just illegal to be homophobic and act on it. It is actually unconstitutional. We are a pro-choice country. Whilst in America, I hear now, you guys are still debating issues of reproductive rights, abortion, and so on and so forth.
You hear that?
In South
yes.
Africa, all those issues were long settled by our constitution. So, you see, we are we have made all those great achievements. But at the same time, there are many things that are very disappointing, some of which I actually wrote to Mandela about. If you read my memoir, you know, you'll follow. Because I've been very critical of this government in South Africa, even though I praise it for those human right things that it introduced. I've been disappointed, for instance, by the crony capitalism, you know, cronyism that we see there, the patronage system, the rampant accumulation of wealth that, you know, by the ruling elite that has led in many instances to corruption. So I've been very critical of all those. And I suspect that my father would actually also be quite critical of that, because he was a very, you know, humble man, he dedicated himself to the people, sometimes even at the expense of his own family. That's one of the things that we used to complain about, actually,
yeah.
when we were growing up, as you know.
The spark for that letter to Mandela was you were to be appointed to the SABC, the South African Broadcasting Company Board, and I think Mandela interceded, and that was denied. But now we have this situation in South Africa where the SABC is seen as corrupt. There's a lot of cronyism. They give favorable coverage to the ANC. Is that a major issue, the state media in South Africa?
Well, I mean, it is a major issue with me. And of course, you know, I do write about these things, not only in my memoir. I write about them in South Africa as well, you know, in the media and all that. You know, one thing, of course, that is wonderful is that I can be as critical as I like in South Africa, and there will be no consequences, you know, no adverse consequences on me on that, you see, because we are free. You see, and that freedom, of course, was brought about by the ANC, by the PAC, and by all the, you know, the liberation movements, you know, that were involved in our struggle. So that's one of the wonderful things about that country. So we have the bad, the good and the bad and the ugly all together there.
Well, I always enjoy a memoir that's interesting but also challenging. And I have to tell you, there were a lot of characters in this memoir. And I noticed that many of them, if not most of them, had last surnames that began with the letter M. Of course, all the Mda relatives did and Mandela did. I will put you on the spot. I counted the number of M last names in the index. How many would you guess it was?
Well, I have no idea. 100.
You ready? 276.
I see.
Yes.
Well, of course, that would be expected of a biography because, you see, that's where this book, you know, differs from a memoir. A memoir or, you know, focuses on one aspect of the author's life. It zooms into that aspect and then becomes reflective of that aspect. An autobiography, on the other hand, you know, is the sketch of the entire life.
Right.
From birth to the time of writing.
Yes.
It includes phases of the author's life, you know, childhood, adolescence, adulthood.
We want to thank you, Professor Zakes Mda, for joining me today. It was a true pleasure.
It was my pleasure, Mike.
And we will go out, because we're playing great South African music, with the Soweto Gospel Choir singing the South African National Anthem. You can read an excerpt from Zakes Mda's new autobiography, Sometimes There Is a Void, Memoirs of an Outsider, on the website, onpointradio.org. I'm Mike Pesca, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Let us live and strive for freedom.